Well, welcome. We had a good week last week. Enjoyed that. Took a little break from the series that we were in. And we've been in this series called Faith on the Edge. And we have looked at certainty and uncertainty, the good that uncertainty can have in our life. We don't have to know everything. And then that moved us to look at faith. We looked at the nature of faith and why that is troubling sometimes, that faith demands of us mystery, and that faith also demands, the last time we were together, it was kind of a hard thing to talk about, but faith demands a certain kind of surrender and trust in God. And we ended, and hopefully this is what you got, because that was heavy, hard stuff. It wasn't something enjoyable. I believe it's true, so I give it to you, but it wasn't something necessarily enjoyable to talk about. But we ended by saying the presence of God isn't found in the absence of suffering and disappointment, but in the midst of them. Sometimes that's difficult to swallow, difficult to hear, but hopefully that was the overall point that we got. Let's say this prayer together before we start tonight. Healing sovereign God, overmatch our resistant ears with your transforming speech. Penetrate our jadedness and fatigue. Touch our yearnings by your words. Through your out loudness, draw us closer to you. We are ready to listen. Amen. May that be true. So we called tonight. I want to move from talking about certainty, uncertainty, talking about the nature of faith and mystery and surrender, and now we'll move to talk a little bit about the hiddenness of God, which many of you at different times throughout the years have talked about this or brought this up, of why doesn't God seem a little bit more obvious. So the question, does God exist? Well, that's a question that can be addressed at many levels, from the highest, most abstract philosophical argument, yet two talking philosophers going at each other, down to the hollowness that you feel in the pit of your stomach as you lay your head on your pillow at night, and then everywhere in between. But I would offer, in a religiously diverse culture that we have, and many people have experienced the end of modernity, the end of the modern age, where all these promises of technology and advancement haven't come through with their promises and have left people just kind of there, I think a more pointed question that people ask is, can God be found? Can he be known? Can I trust God? Why does God seem so far away? We who are believers in the way of Jesus, we find ourselves in the same territory, in the same domain as those who don't believe in God. We see the same circumstances that unbelievers see. We thrill over the same sunset. We agonize over the same multitude of unfed children in the world. And most of the believers that I know don't have regular visions from God. They don't constantly hear God's voice in their life. We aren't constantly seeing miracles that we can kind of capture and prove God in some kind of scientific, demonstrable way. And like unbelievers, those of us who believe are troubled by the same evil and pain that we see in the world and the suffering that comes into our own lives. And like them, we are often disappointed with other Christians and the church. And yet, some of us choose to believe in and bet our existence on a God we cannot see, cannot touch, cannot hear, cannot necessarily prove. And others choose to bet their entire existence on the notion that such a God does not exist. So the question is this: if God is there, why doesn't he make more noise? I think that puts a bunt. If God wants people to believe in him, right, why doesn't he make himself more obvious? Have you ever thought, oh, why does God just not one day part the clouds and write his name in the sky, like Charlotte's Web? Remember that story? pigs writing all kinds of things on the web, right? Is God an introvert? Is he shy? I mean, why isn't there more compelling proof and evidence? Poets and writers and musicians, they have long been looking for God. Emily Dickinson said this, "At least to pray is left. O Jesus in the air, I know not which thy chamber is. I'm knocking everywhere." Bob Dylan, a century later, uses that same metaphor, knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. At least it seems like he has the right door that he's knocking on. One of the most famous atheists in the last century was a guy named Bertrand Russell. And supposedly the story is when he was about 90 years old, he was at a party and he had this famous confrontation with a lady. And the lady noted to him, "You're not only the world's famous atheist, but you're also the world's oldest atheist." And her point was that you will die soon, and what will happen after you die if it turns out that God does exist? She said it like this, "What will you do if you come face to face with this God whom you defied your whole life long?" And Bertrand Russell said, "I would point his finger in God's face and say, 'You, sir, gave us insufficient evidence.'" Woody Allen, he had a little bit more of a concrete suggestion. He said he'd believe in God if God would just give him an unmistakable sign, like making a large deposit in a Swiss bank account in his name. There was another atheist philosopher named, not as popular, Norwood Russell Hansen. He said this to people, "I'm not a stubborn individual. I can change. I would become a believer or a theist under certain conditions." He was trying to show people he was open-minded. And then this is what he did. This is the conditions he laid out under which he would believe. This is meant to be funny. You're allowed to laugh a little bit. Suppose next Tuesday morning, just after breakfast, all of us in this world are knocked to our knees by a percussive and ear-shattering thunderclap. Snow swirls, leaves drop from the tree, the earth heaves and buckles, buildings topple, towers tumble. The sky is ablaze with an eerie silvery light, and just then, all the people of the world look up, the heavens open, the clouds pull apart, revealing an unbelievably radiant and immense Zeus-like figure towering over us like 100 Everest. He frowns darkly as lightning plays over the features of his Michelangeloid face. And then he points down at me and explains, "For every man, woman, and child to hear, I've had quite enough of your too clever logic chopping and word watching in matters of theology. Be assured, Norwood Russell Hansen, I most certainly do exist." So if just all that happened, then I would believe in God. And I would think, yeah, I mean, to get the middle name treatment would certainly be a head turner, no doubt about it. Deus absconditus rolls off the tongue well. This was Martin Luther's term that God is hidden, secret, cryptic at times, even absent. And we've seen this in the series. God both reveals, there's a revelation. God wants to reveal, open up to us, but God also conceals. Now he's there, now he's not. Theologians debate it, philosophers argue about it, real people live this out in real time. But even those who accompanied Jesus, people that felt his power, they were sometimes confused as to who he exactly was. But the hiddenness of God, this is a topic. I mean, how many of you have ever heard anything on this? This isn't a topic talked about a lot in the evangelical world. Not cheery enough, perhaps. You know, better to emphasize God's availability. He's always present. He's always ready to help and speak. It's just we that do not have ears to hear. And then there's this other truth about God, that he is a bloodhound. You say, what? Well, Victorian poet Francis Thompson, you probably all heard lines from this poem called "The Hound of Heaven." And in that poem, it's you and I that's doing the hiding, and God is like a bloodhound always pursuing through the ages. Kind of a famous poem. So if you've ever heard "The Hound of Heaven," that's where that comes from. There's a lot of artists and poets and musicians and writers who talk about God as being all around. Gerard Manley Hopkins, he finds God everywhere. You read him, it's in the colors of the dragonfly, in the morning sunrise, in his laboring neighbor's face. He describes it like this: Christ plays in 10,000 places. Eugene Peterson stole that for a title of his book, which is a great title. But a lot of these artists would say to you, how can you not see God? He's crying out from every nook and cranny of the universe. How could you miss him? So I think that's our dilemma we want to wrestle with the next couple weeks. So which is it? Is God hiding? Not there? Not listening? Or maybe even more maddening, he's listening but not answering? He's on vacation? I imagine it's easy for God to lose track of time. Millennia can pass, and for him, it's just been a few busy days. Is God playing hard to get with people? Or is God always hanging around, always waving his hands like this, hoping that we'll notice? Is God always speaking, hoping that you and I will listen? Is he always available, hoping you and I will make ourselves available as well? Now, someone simply stop us tonight and say, you guys don't need to waste your time the next couple weeks. The fact that you're bringing this up, the fact that you talk about the hiddenness of God or that you struggle with this is just like proof and evidence that God doesn't exist. Or if God magically exists, then he wants to be left alone and for us to get on with our lives and with civilization without any reference to him. Or is there other options? Perhaps God has good reasons for not wanting to be obvious. Can you think of situations in your life where you have hid? I used to work with teenagers. I was a youth pastor for a while, and one of the fun things that I did is on Wednesday nights, we would break, and we had a lot of young people, we would break kids up into small groups, and they had youth sponsors, and it was kind of like take about 150 teens and kind of, and they would spread out all over the building. But the fun thing I did, and the other youth sponsors that helped me, fought me on this, but I got my way on this, I would take the seniors every year. And it did it to kind of help prepare for college, these big questions that are going to come up. And we had a good time. We would eat together on Wednesday nights, and we would read certain books or articles, and we would sit around and talk. And it was meant for dialogue, for them to interact and ask those kind of questions. But as a pastor, I quickly figured out I had to often be a silent partner. If I were to give too many answers, others would be tempted to pull back, and my presence could intimidate. I would sometimes, they would be talking in dialogue, and sometimes they would wait, and it's like, okay, we've dialogued long enough, what's the answer, give it to us, you know? And so I often had to pull back because it would stop being a community dialogue, and it would be more like a one-way monologue, and the whole goal was for them to develop, to think, to disagree with each other, but still come to some good conclusion. So I had to stay in the background. I think we even had something online where if they were reading during the week, they could ask certain questions, and I didn't always type in the answer. I think we understand this. Think of our role as parents. We don't want to loom too large in our children's considerations as they grow. I don't want them to choose a career or a marriage partner based on what I want. My will is that they make those choices themselves, that they would be their own people. They would develop their own personalities. They would live out their own stories, not like just huddle in my shadow. Granted, as parents, we don't want to be ignored, right? We want our kids to come to us even later in life. We want to be able to offer advice. But if we want to see them develop into the unique people that they are, that forces us a lot of times, right, to restrain ourselves. To not always jump in, to not always give our opinion, to not help every time that they ask for help. Sometimes let them suffer the consequences. To not do their homework for them, if you will, but to help them develop by not helping them. Does that make sense? So think, if that is God's goal for you and I to develop, to have freedom, to make unpressured choices in life, to become the unique people that we will be, not because the big guy standing over us and looking over our shoulder, but for natural, unforced reasons, right? For love, because of courage, because of integrity or justice, then perhaps God is forced to stay subtle. We could say behind the scenes. Think of that. Present to us, always present, but not too obvious. Think of that. Involved, but also ignorable. Here, present, but also hidden. C.S. Lewis says it like this in Screwtape Letters. I like this. He wants them to learn to walk and must therefore take away his hand. See, maybe God's silence is actually intended to tell us something. Maybe it's intended to reveal something about God. Maybe it reveals to us a God who listens more than he speaks. Maybe it reveals a God who wants to make room for us to live our lives without constant intrusion or interference or domination always standing over our shoulder. Maybe he's a God who reveals, but also hides and conceals. A God who interacts and is intricately involved in his creation. Like creation just didn't happen at the beginning, but there's this sense of ongoing creation. He's involved. He woos people. He woos his creation. He wishes a relationship, but he's also a God who is altogether different from his creation. The scriptures say, a God who draws near to those who seek him, but a God who's not a dog who comes every time that you whistle. A God who's intimate and close and loving, but a God who is also strange and to be feared. See, I think deep down if I say that, we know that that's true, but don't we all wish it to be different? We would like God to be as dependable as the morning paper. Now I'm dating myself a little bit there, because probably everybody gets it now on tablets, but I think you get the idea. The morning paper, always there. Ready to be picked up or not as we desire, waiting patiently for us to develop enough interest. That's how we would like God. Or when we need God, when we're in trouble, when we're seeking him, when we need an answer to a question, we want God on call, right? Like a loyal butler. That just happens to be my favorite butler. Batman's butler, Alfred Pennyworth, just so you know. But that's how we sometimes would like God, standing in the wings, waiting for the bell to ring. And what you quickly find out is that God is not that way. Sometimes we ring and we ring and we ring, and he never comes, so it seems. The saints throughout the ages, I've noticed this a lot. I'm going to put it in my words, but I've noticed a lot of the saints have said this, that it seems that God is more likely to show himself to those who are seeking a relationship and less likely to those who are merely seeking information. I've always found that interesting, that it seems that a lot of the saints said, it seems like God is more readily available, more revealing when people are coming to him out of love, this ongoing relationship, rather than just coming because, God, there's a problem, this person needs to be healed, I need an answer to this question. So they notice God exposes, reveals, opens up to those who are lifting their hands in love, saying, I want to be in this ongoing relationship, and sometimes hidden and less likely for those who, God, I need something, not a genie. Although, as I say that, I'm not being entirely fair, because I think there's those times where our motives can be sincere and our attitudes really appropriate, and still it feels like there's nobody home. For a moment tonight, consider Agnes. Think of Agnes. From the time she was a young girl, she believed. I mean, she not just believed, she believed with all of her being. She wrote down, she wanted to love Jesus more than anybody had ever before. There's a goal. And she knew Jesus was close to her, and she knew there was this undeniable call on her life. And at one time, she wrote in her journal, "My soul is at present in perfect peace and joy." She just had this deep feeling of union with God, and it felt continual and ongoing. And as she grew up, she eventually left home. She became a missionary, and she left everything and gave up everything. And then God left her. At least that's how it felt to her. She began to write in her journal, "Where is my faith? Even deep down, there's nothing but emptiness and darkness. My God, how painful is this unknown pain? I have no faith." She said she tried to pray. I utter words of community prayers. I try my utmost to get out of every word the sweetness that it has to give, but my prayer of union is no longer there. On the outside, she worked, she served, she smiled, but she spoke of her smile as a mask, a cloak that covers everything. And that inner darkness, that dryness, that pain over the seeming silence and absence of God continued over years. She talked about there was one period of respite, but pretty much over a 50-year period. Such was the secret pain of Agnes, who is known to us as Mother Teresa. Her letters expressed her inner torment, and they were hidden, obviously, during her life in service. And when she died, she asked that be destroyed, but sometimes those things don't work out as we would control them. But a strange thing happened, because her willingness to persist in the face of agonizing doubt brought a lot of comfort and strength to people, whereas if she had lived an inner life of ease and certainty, it wouldn't have helped. All of her life, she was a servant to the poor, but in her anguish, she became a missionary to those who question and doubt. And we look at that story and we go, man, how are we to understand that? I think it definitely does this for us tonight. It warns us about easy formulas that guarantee making us closer to God. Read this, do this, get up early in the morning, spend an hour with God, and you'll be close. I think it warns us of those kind of easy formulas. There's an old saying that says, if you don't feel close to God anymore, who is moved? And I think that's true in certain situations. Certainly the prophet Nathan confronting King David after Bathsheba Gate, that makes sense, right? You know, David, you don't feel close to God. Well, you know, there's this thing. But I wouldn't have wanted to say that of Mother Teresa or other saints that I read about, you know, who were deeply pursuing God and still felt some of this darkness. Now, again, some people, of course, would step in and say, you're all being just silly. Like, Mother Teresa was just butting up against the reality that God isn't there after all. A modern atheist, Christopher Hitchens, he said she was no more exempt from the realization that religion is a human fabrication than any other person, and her attempted cure was more and more professions of faith that only deepened the pit that she had dug for herself. Richard Dawkins, another famous atheist, he said, don't be taken in by the sanctimoniously hypocritical Mother Teresa. This, for me, it seems like a bad strategy. If you're trying to convince people of atheism, taking a shot at Mother Teresa probably isn't your best move, is my thought process. But Mother Teresa, she didn't have this negative understanding. She didn't reject God, but neither did she overcome her pain of God's silence in her life. And rather, in a strange way, it became a part of her. It was just kind of woven into the fabric of her being. I like this. She met with a wise counselor one time, and he said some things to her that stayed with her. The first thing he said is, this isn't your fault. This was somebody who was pursuing God in all the time. So he says that this doesn't necessarily have a remedy from the human side. What we're quick to do is say, well, you're doing it wrong. Do it this way. This is sin. You've got something. We're quick to do that. And the counselor says, no. This isn't your fault. Another thing he said to her is, I like this, feeling the presence of Jesus was not the only or even primary evidence of his presence. So feeling, as great as that is when it's happening, feeling the presence of Jesus isn't the only evidence of his presence. Jesus himself said, you'll know them by their fruits, not by their certainty. So he told Mother Teresa, in fact, your very craving and longing for God is a sure sign that God is present, though in a hidden way. I like that. And the last thing he said to her was that the pain that she was going through could actually be redemptive. Have you thought of this deeply? Jesus himself experienced the agony of the absence of God. I'm not saying there was a disconnect, but I think in the incarnation, Jesus comes and stands right where Adam and Eve is, naked and ashamed in the garden, hiding, and he feels that. The whole point is that he stands in your shoes, and he sees what you see, and he feels what you feel, and he feels that breakage of, my God, why would you abandon me? Jesus feels that. And yet his suffering was redemptive for us. So he said to her, you can suffer redemptively by holding on, by moving forward, even in the midst of darkness. Someone said this, never doubt in the darkness what God has shown you in the light. I really like that. Never doubt when it's dark and you don't see clearly what God has clearly revealed to you and what you've come to know as you've walked with him in the light. And I think that became Mother Teresa's last greatest gift maybe to the world. Maybe, just maybe, there are good reasons why God doesn't show up in the sky. Perhaps God's goal for the human race is more than just getting people to admit that he exists. We Christians kind of do, boy, if you just admit that God's there, maybe his goal is bigger than that. Because if you think about it, that doesn't really solve the problem of the human race. Even if we all admitted God exists, the problem of the human heart is still there. Think of this. You're driving by and you see a black and white squad car on the street. And if you're like me, you finally see your intention to obey the speed limit goes really high at that point. And when it does, your heart has not changed. Your deep driving inner convictions haven't changed. It's pain avoidance, right? I know I'm speaking myself and I'm putting on that you, but I have a feeling that you might identify a little bit with what I'm saying. And then if you eventually do get pulled over, what are some of our first thoughts? Hey, there's murderers and thieves out there. What are you doing? Aren't you supposed to be getting the bad guys, not picking on, you know, a good tax-paying citizen? Or you think to yourself, man, this guy just has to get his quota. He's probably behind. He's probably kind of a loser police officer and hasn't met his quota for the month or the year, and so he's got to pull me over to get his quota. See, what happens is our own darkness and our own self-preoccupation prevent us from seeing the officer objectively for who he is. What we do is we project our own fears, our own desires, our own selfishness and darkness, and all of that filters the way that we see him. Multiply that 1,000 times over and you begin to see God's dilemma in dealing with the human race. We have trouble seeing God's face. We have trouble seeing God as he is because we project our own fallenness onto God. And so getting people to just believe in the mere existence of God doesn't do a lot of good. People can believe in the existence of God and still live lives of complete disaster. You remember the passage from James. You believe that there is one God. Good, even the demons believe that and they tremble with fear. Do the demons believe the same things about God that Jesus believed about his Father? No. Do what they believe about God, does it fill their heart with hope and assurance and joy? Not at all. And so God seems to present himself in such a way that people who want to dismiss God will be able to dismiss him. Did you hear that? God seems to present himself in such a way that people who want to dismiss God can dismiss him. He seems to leave space for that. Again, Christians often don't. But God leaves space for that. People who do not want there to be a God will often find a way to believe that there is no God. Pascal said it like this. I always loved this. There is enough light out there for those who want to see, and there is enough darkness for those of a different persuasion. Pascal was saying, look, God has revealed, God has shown himself, and there is enough light, there is enough out there if you want to see it. But he's also hidden and concealed, and there's enough darkness that if you want to be of that persuasion, you can be. Friends, that is the human condition. That's really what we've been saying in this series is look, you don't have 100% certainty. Nobody does, which actually leaves room for and requires faith. So we're all now on a level playing ground. We all have an element of faith. The question is the faith good? Is it moving you forward? Is it giving you an open mind? Is it enlarging you? Or is it stagnant and decaying, pulling you backwards? And this faith journey often involves a great deal of mystery and questions. And sometimes a lot, because you don't have it all, surrender and trust that somebody does. That's what it means to be human. And I think part of growing, part of maturing, is learning to accept that. Even Hopkins, who found Christ in 10,000 places, he knew darkness as well. In one of his poems, he wrote, "Comforter, where is your comforting?" Another time he wrote, "My lament is cries countless, cries like dead letters sent to dearest him that lives, alas, away." In feeling God sometimes close and sometimes far away, I am experiencing what people have of faith have experienced throughout the Bible into this age. Think of the psalm, the middle part of your canon. The prayer book, the worship, the song book of the church. Think of the vast array of emotions and feelings you find in there. I sometimes always think of the not vast array of emotions there are sometimes in worship songs. It doesn't sometimes the same, but you open the psalms, it's like try to find one that's not there. And there's this thing about that that inspires me some to think, ever since this time of Jesus, there's been this tradition that people of faith have experienced all of these emotions. It's never quite predictable. It's never formulaic. Hey, since the time of Jesus and before, people have experienced this whole palette of colors of emotions, that's part of what it means to follow God. And even God, again, knows that feeling. The same Jesus who said, "I and the Father are one," who is the same Jesus who on the cross says, "God, why have you forsaken?" What I want to end with is this. What none of the biblical people of faith did was stop looking. I can understand. Maybe you can't. I can understand why somebody would be an atheist. The evidence for God isn't irrefutable, and humans are really good at refuting whatever does not appeal to them. See? And what I understand less, though, is why anybody would stop looking. How can I decide at 15 or 35 or 67 that there is no God and at least not keep that question open for the rest of your life for further input? I mean, is there really a bigger question than that? Does anything change our understanding of and our acting in the world more than the answer to that question? Which I often say to people, which means I have to allow the possibility to the answer to that question might be, no, there is no God. I have to stay open to evidence too. Maybe all that God hunger is just wishing. Maybe you and I are just accidental creatures on a smallish planet revolving around a minor star in one of countless galaxies, and we're waiting for extinction. Just because the view is grim doesn't mean it's untrue. And we do this, we kind of characterize, we put Christianity or whatever religion in a positive light, and we always put atheists in this dark light. I think there's more positive spin on that. It isn't all just, well, we're sitting back waiting for extinction. A lot of times it's, hey, rage against the night. I like that kind of atheism at least. You know, rage against the night. If this is the end of all things, then hey, let's carve out a piece of our existence and try to change history while we're here. But I would say to you that, that's not my view. It's not my view because if you look at Scripture, if you look at the great church tradition, if you look at reason, experience, and even evidence, it compels me to not adopt that view. So I don't buy it. I believe I am offered, and I believe I have accepted a place in a better story. And my story has both dark nights of the soul and mountaintop experiences. My story has a God who has died to be known and yet can never be fully known. This story has a God who hides and sometimes conceals, and a God who also plays and dances in 10,000 places. So I think the encouragement is, let's join those artists and musicians and writers and theologians and philosophers and pastors through the century. And the goal is we keep knocking, knock, knock, knock on every door. Christianity's hard. We saw the last time we were together, it's difficult. It doesn't mean the elimination. It doesn't just mean comfort and ease and security because now God is on my side. But anything else is boring. Jesus says, I've come so you have life to the full. So we keep knocking. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, we remember in the midst of our singing and praying and celebrating you in your resurrection and the life that you shared with us tonight, that at times in our life it seems that you pull away or that you are absent. It seems that you are not as readily available. It seems sometimes we go cold and dark. It seems sometimes there's big revelation and everything is like crystal clear and makes sense, and other times there is this just darkness. We don't know what the next step is. And whether we like it or not, we celebrate that you are who you are. That you are big enough, massive enough, huge enough, that just at the point that we think we have grasped and put walls around you, you break through. And so that is why we also worship. We are uncertain. We have questions. We have doubts. These hard times hit and we begin to question everything that we assumed we know, but we come and we sing and we say these words and remind us of this big, huge, massive God who loves and reveals and conceals and hides. It isn't ready every time we snap our fingers. And we want to learn to be okay with that. So we ask you to help us tonight, to guide us, especially in those dark moments. Help us in the moments that are grandiose and seemingly easy to also remember that you are beyond even that. The greatest moment that we've ever had here on planet Earth, that you are beyond and greater than that. And so tonight we continue to worship and praise you.